At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For the last several years, a group of economists has cited terrorism as the biggest threat to our economic security. Can you guess what's finally supplanted it? All subprime, all the time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 27th day of August. Sick of hearing about subprime? Eh, you're not the only one. But don't count on it going away anytime soon. A survey out today from the National Association of Business Economics may add some fuel to the fire. The trade group's members said defaults on subprime loans now pose a bigger threat to the U.S. economy than terrorism. And to top it all off, some pretty grim housing numbers today. Anybody want to start tossing around the R word? Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look.
There are 4.5 million unsold homes sitting on the market, according to the National Association of Realtors.
This is starting to look like a typical housing recession.
Housing economist David LeRae says the real problem is that people can't get the home loans they need.
Too many homes and not enough buyers is basically what's happening right now. There may be buyers out there, but they can't obtain a mortgage.
That doesn't worry UCLA economist Edward Lehmer. He says banks will adjust quickly and the loan market will loosen up. Lehmer says what concerns him is that home sellers are holding out for the high prices of a few months ago.
It's sort of a standoff between buyers and sellers. What we've got to get to in the housing sector is back to normal, where when you buy a home, you feel confident that the price is going to be maintained or it's going to go up a little bit.
Lehmer says that standoff could increase the risk of a recession. If activity slows down too much in the housing sector, he says, it could mean job losses and a serious economic slowdown. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
So if you don't want to invest in the housing market right now, and you've been a tad reluctant to put more money into a falling stock market, what else? How about corporate bonds? Apparently, they're the next hot old thing. Marilyn Cohen joins us. She's a bond trader and author of The Bond Bible. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So what's happening here? Folks not terribly interested in the stock market right now, but very interested in corporate debt. Why?
Well, corporate debt has been shunned during this repricing the last 2 months, meaning that prices went down and yields went up dramatically. And so I think people just got a little bit weary of being whipped around in the equity market and have said, you know what, now that rates are up a little bit or quite a bit in corporate bonds, I think it's time to allocate some of my assets to that asset class as opposed to keeping all of it in the equity market all the time.
So at this point, you're getting more for your money and you don't have perhaps as much risk as if you were in the stock market right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the bond market's repricing has made it, you know, significantly more attractive to investors who wanted nothing to do with it last year at this time.
But it seems like what we've been hearing is that corporate debt is bad now, that, you know, nobody wants to get into this credit market. It's a mess. So why go in? Is it really just bargain hunting?
Yes, it's bargain hunting. It's looking for opportunities when everybody else is just, you know, saying, get me the heck out of here. I only want treasuries.
Right.
And as a portfolio manager, you know, that's my job. That's what I'm paid to do. I mean, I sat for almost all of last year and a good portion of this year, mostly in government agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Federal Home Loan Bank bonds. And so I was, you know, very, very risk averse. Now that the spreads are widened and it looks like temporarily, at least, some of the private equity firms are on the sidelines, you've got a better deal going forward.
What else are you buying?
Well, I'm looking at good quality credit like Sprint, you know, names that are somewhat everyday names that aren't too esoteric, that hopefully are too big to be taken over by another company. I would take a look, if you want to sift through some of the rubble, at Costco Wholesale. Has some bonds due in 2012. I think Xerox is a good name, and that bond has come back from the dead.
Does it surprise you all that corporate debt is all of a sudden the darling?
Well, it's not surprising, because everything that gets overdone in the market then becomes hated and despised. And that's when you want to buy it. But, you know,
wait, are you saying we're all extremists?
Yes, absolutely. Investors are always extreme. Look at the mania we saw in the equity market.
Right.
Well, you know, if you thought that was bad, you should have been sitting in my seat, because the mania in the bond market was many times worse than that.
All right. Marilyn Cohen is the president of Envision Capital here in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Attention, Walmart shoppers. The next generation of your favorite store may look less like a supercenter and just a little bit more like a mini mart. Well, okay, not that small. But the world's largest retailer could be moving toward a more intimate shopping experience. A story in today's Financial Times says Walmart is looking for an executive to help shape a downsized store strategy. The company would neither confirm nor deny, but several analysts say they've been expecting Walmart to get bigger by going smaller. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has more.
Walmart spokesman John Simley wouldn't be recorded today, but when asked about the small store strategy, he said the company would never rule anything out. Simley did say Walmart wants to hire mid-level executives to, quote, evaluate our existing formats. The Financial Times says Walmart's responding to a new U.S. initiative by British food giant Tesco. Tesco's planning lots of new neighborhood grocery stores called Fresh and Easy here. That notion prompts a chuckle from analyst George Whalen of Retail Management Consultants.
My guess is that Walmart is not afraid of Tesco.
But Whalen says Walmart will go smaller with future stores.
You've got states like California, and you've got northeastern states where real estate is very difficult to come by. So you look at other formats, and you can get closer to the customer in smaller formats in neighborhoods and communities.
Retail analyst Bernie Sosnick is with Oppenheimer & Company. He says Walmart's already tested the small store strategy in Mexico and Central America. Sosnick says it could be a path to future growth here as well.
By stratifying in this way, Walmart can serve different shoppers at different income levels better than it can with one large supercenter of almost 200,000 square feet.
Sosnick and Whalen both say there's still a lot more life in the supercenter. There are 2,300 of them out there now and more planned. But they agree the expansion of giant stores will reach a point of diminishing returns soon. And they also say that Walmart is sure to have answers ready when it comes to what to do next. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, those housing figures Stacy talked about just nagged at investors, at least the ones who showed up on this light trading day. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today in New Orleans, four of the presidential candidates were attending a recovery summit. Wednesday marks the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. One of the many, many indelible images of the disaster was all those cars and trucks tossed around by the storm, sometimes deposited on rooftops or atop a telephone pole. Some of those cars ended up in the unlikeliest of places, Bolivia. They're sold on the cheap and look almost new on the outside. But many of these so-called Katrina cars aren't exactly the bargain they seem. Ruxandra Guidi has more from La Paz.
About 40 minutes from the Bolivian capital of La Paz is the sprawling slum of El Alto. In the local market there, you're likely to come across hundreds of used cars. The cars are spread out in the middle of the streets over 20 city blocks. Salesmen stand beside them for hours, ready to answer questions. Well, sort of. This man is selling a 97 Toyota Corolla for $6,000. He tells me the car came directly from Japan. But many of the cars selling at this market are also coming straight from the U.S., and they're selling for even lower prices. They're known here as Autos Katrina, cars that were damaged by the 2005 hurricane in Louisiana and Mississippi and can no longer be sold in the U.S. Freddie Koch is a chemical engineer studying these Katrina cars for an environmental nonprofit organization in La Paz.
Katrina cars come here because Bolivia has allowed the import of used cars for the past 5 years. Initially, we started importing many cars from Japan, but we've also started to see many used cars from the U.S. and Europe. Bolivia now has a big market for these cars, which, by the way, is not the case in other countries in South America.
Cox says the cars are first sold by American insurance companies looking to get rid of the damaged merchandise. The companies look for markets nearby, but Mexico and most Central and South American countries have strict laws against the import of used and especially damaged cars. Bolivia doesn't. Bolivia also has an extensive contraband network and lacks laws that make it the perfect place to dump these cars and still make a profit. Alejandro Numbela is a manager with Toyota Cars in La Paz. He says that few Bolivians can afford brand new vehicles. He says the steady influx of these Katrina cars hurts his business. In 1998, car dealerships in Bolivia sold a total of 10,000 new cars. This year, he says, he's expecting the total to be only about 5,000 cars.
Just so you have an idea, a brand new Toyota truck this year will cost you about $27,000. A similar Katrina car will cost about $12,000, so about 50% less. These cars really do distort our market because they're cheap and of poor quality.
According to environmentalist Freddie Koch, there are hundreds of Katrina car owners in La Paz alone. But finding them is difficult, and getting them to admit to buying a Katrina car is even harder still. Ramiro Sanchez has agreed to meet me at a coffee shop in downtown La Paz. He says his friend bought a Katrina car months ago and took it to Sanchez's repair shop once he started having problems with it.
So a friend of mine bought a Mini Cooper on one of these American internet auctions. When the car got to Bolivia, we had to take mud out of the engine. The electrical wiring was completely corroded, and the car was useless. The only thing that looks good is the exterior, because it was repainted. The rest is completely rotten.
Sanchez says his friend thought he'd be saving money by buying the car in auction for $7,000. But paying for taxes and shipping it to Bolivia cost him an extra $8,000, and repairing it in full will add another $8,000 to the bill. All in all, the refurbished Mini Cooper will end up costing more than a brand new one, and it'll be another 6 months before it's ready to be driven again. In La Paz, Bolivia, I'm Ruxandra Guidi for Marketplace.
Dale Carnegie's 1936 classic, How to Make Friends and Influence People, lists six ways to do just that. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has spent the last several months adding a seventh method to win friends and influence around Latin America. Throw oil money around. Today, the Associated Press decided to add up his largesse. This year alone, it came to $8.8 billion. Makes the $3 billion the U.S. gives look kind of paltry, doesn't it? From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch takes a peek behind the numbers.
health clinics in Bolivia, electricity plants in Haiti, AIDS treatment in Nicaragua.
It does sound like Chavez is going around the region like Santa Claus, promising everything.
Adam Isaacson's with the Center for International Policy. He says the fact that Venezuela has pledged its neighbors $9 billion is shocking.
But more shocking is how little aid the United States gives in Latin America. It's much stingier, and it's gone down significantly in constant dollar terms since the end of the Cold War. Latin America is really off the map.
Chavez has used these monies to show up the United States.
That's Bruce Bagley with the University of Miami. He says the U.S. offers military funding, debt relief, and small business loans. Meanwhile, Chavez offers free eye surgery to poor people.
Chavez has been far more effective than our public diplomacy. He has certainly made inroads and has continued to chip away at the United States' reputation throughout the region.
U.S. policymakers say Venezuela can't keep all of its aid promises, and the U.S. has learned over the years that Chavez-style handouts simply don't work. Susan Kaufman-Purcell directs the Center for Hemispheric Studies in Miami.
Part of it is the whole argument, you can give a guy a fish or you can teach him how to fish. The U.S. side says we're trying to teach him how to fish.
But impoverished Latin Americans feel like they're drowning, and a fishing pole doesn't float. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, South African women get lessons in love and lending.
A lot of them thought, it is expected for a man to cheat on me.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets sagged today as the overhang of unsold homes hit its highest level in more than a decade and a half. The Dow peeled off 56 points, 0.4% to settle at 13,322. 15 points flaked off the NASDAQ, pushing it down 0.6% to end at 2561. The S&P 500 chipped away 12 points, 0.8% to end at 1466. Goldman Sachs cut the earnings per share forecast on three investment banks. Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers each swooned more than 4%, and Morgan Stanley lost 1.25%. Countrywide Financial, the country's biggest U.S. mortgage lender, dropped 4.75% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its monthly index of consumer confidence. President Bush addresses the American Legion at their annual convention in Reno. Then he'll fly to New Orleans ahead of the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And NASA announces the contractor selected to build part of the Ares 1, a new rocket to take humans to the moon and perhaps eventually Mars. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdal. In Greece, dozens of people have died in a series of savage forest fires that ripped across the country over the last 2 days. The blazes have also threatened the nation's crucial tourist industry. Greek authorities have declared a state of emergency, and they're offering a hefty reward to anyone who can help nab the arsonists they suspect are behind the fires. Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is here with some details. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
Well, there is talk already that this could be arson caused. What's the latest?
Yes, indeed. The government certainly believes that some of these fires were set, that arsonists have been at work. More than 30 suspects, in fact, have already been arrested. And the government's offered a reward of about $1.5 million for further information. One theory, a lot of theories have been spreading around, is that rogue real estate developers may be behind this, that they may have torched an area of protected forest land so that they would it would then become possible to develop that land. Now, as yet, there's no hard proof of that, but that is one rumor that is gaining ground.
Now, Greece has obviously gone beyond its own capacity to fight these fires, and there are crews in from all over the European Union. How is that paid for?
Well, initially, it'll be paid for by the countries involved, and the effort is unprecedented. Something like 11 countries have donated help with firefighter planes and helicopters and specially trained personnel, and the help has come from as far afield as Canada. But what the Greeks will be able to do within days is apply to what is called the EU's Solidarity Fund. This was set up a few years ago precisely to help member states deal with disasters like this.
Now, that is the aid for countries involved. What about victims of this fire? You know, if something like this were to happen in the U.S., people would be asking for aid from the federal government. What does a small country like Greece do in this kind of situation?
Well, all they can do at this stage is get this emergency financial aid. In the case of Greece, clearly it is going to be much less money than in the case of the federal government. It is a relatively poor country. It is a relatively poor member state in the EU. In fact, eventually, in time, Greece will be able to turn back to the European Union if it can prove that its economy and its infrastructure have been very seriously damaged by the fires. It may be able to get a great deal more financial aid for reconstruction from the EU.
All right. Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Okay, Tess.
Officials in Utah said yesterday that they would continue searching for the six men trapped in that collapsed mine. They've sent a special robot camera down a hole to see if there's any sign of life. Meanwhile, last Friday, the Bush administration introduced one of the most far-reaching changes in coal mining policy in the last decade. It would loosen the requirement that coal operators prove their strip mining doesn't damage streams and wildlife. The public has 90 days to file comments. Here's one already from commentator Jeff Biggers.
In the summer of 1983, I first hiked along the famed Appalachian Trail and worked on mountain farms. Then I was taken into the West Virginia coal fields and saw something else. In one depressed coal mining community after another, strip mining had devastated the ridges. 25 years later, the most extreme form of strip mining, mountaintop removal, has become an economic boondoggle for Appalachia. Once bustling communities in the coal fields have become ghost towns. Blasting, coal hauling, and unsafe roads have damaged, flooded out, and made unlivable countless numbers of communities. Huge dragline machines that scoop away the mountains have shrunk coal field employment by 90%. Tourism might soon be the worst casualty. Tourism brings in some $30 billion a year in a dozen states in southern Appalachia, more than any other industry, including coal. In West Virginia alone, in fact, tourism rivals coal. Both account for $3.5 billion of revenue each year, but not for long. The dull haze of coal pollution has slashed visibility along the Appalachian Trail and as far as the Great Smoky Mountains in Tennessee and North Carolina. The coal industry uses 1 million metric tons of explosives a year to blow up the mountains in this region. This explosive force, equal to 58 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs, has wiped out more than 1 million acres of forest, 1,000 miles of streams, and 475 actual mountains. Strip mining has left behind a new Appalachian Trail of destruction. If mountaintop removal becomes the poster image of tourism, Appalachia's economy and its ridges will one day look like the dusty prairies of Crawford, Texas.
Jeff Biggers is the author of The United States of Appalachia. Your comments, head to our website, marketplace.org, and click on the button that says Contact. buzz around microfinance really caught on last year when Bangladesh's Grameen Bank and its founder, Muhammad Yunus, won the Nobel Peace Prize. In microfinance, lenders give money to people who wouldn't be able to get a loan from a large traditional bank. The transactions can often involve very small amounts of money, but can make a huge difference in developing countries. One South African group has added a twist by providing additional training to its entrepreneurs in the heart of the world's AIDS pandemic. Gretchen Wilson reports.
In this old hall, two women are role-playing how a wife can ask her husband to use a condom. This isn't local theater. The rural women in this audience are actually here for short-term loans of up to $1,300. These support their businesses as dressmakers or vegetable sellers. Some are grandmas in Sunday hats. Others are teenagers with babies wrapped on their backs. They're all part of a program called Intervention with Microfinance for AIDS and Gender Equity. It combines microfinance with these workshops on gender equality. Attendance is mandatory every other week, and there's a roll call.
You know, the incentive to come is cash, but they're able to access a public health program that they otherwise wouldn't be exposed to.
That's Dr. Paul Pronick with the University of the Witwatersrand. A recent study found that in 3 years, this program has not only reduced poverty, it's also dropped the incidence of physical and sexual abuse by 55%.
The reason that's important is that gender-based violence is a massive risk factor for HIV in South Africa.
One in every three adults here is already HIV positive. Training coordinator Lulu Ndlovu says one reason is that women accept sexual infidelity.
A lot of them thought it is expected for a man to cheat on me, to such an extent that if you had a husband and he doesn't cheat on you, you were like, what's wrong with him? So when we came with the training, people were saying, really? That's not supposed to happen. No wonder it was so uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, yes, but trainer Rachel Madondo says many here think women who don't bring income into the family can't say no to a husband, even if he has many sexual partners.
So most of the women think that, it's my duty, even if I don't want to have sex, or he can beat me and then he can say, let's have sex, then you should never object because he's your husband.
All of this puts these women at greater risk of contracting the virus. Madondo herself is now HIV positive, but she says the training gave her more self-confidence and she became economically empowered with her first loan.
But since I started working, it started to change little by little. I realized that also I was in an abusive relationship.
Many women are coming to similar realizations and say this program has been a major turning point in their lives. They're building household savings for the first time, and some are even sending their children to college. As the woman closed today's meeting with a song, Betty Nkele says she's proud to have a financial stake in her household.
My business has improved and I'm more aware of myself now. I've got plans, my own plans, so I'm not waiting for my husband to come home with money. I'm building my own future.
It's a future that includes talking to her husband about her feelings and showing him how she wants to be treated. In Mooihoek, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, as summer winds to a close, you may find yourself a bit nostalgic for those smells of summer. Bonfires, beaches, backyard grass clippings. Well, just head north to a certain liquor store in Halifax, Nova Scotia. They'll be pumping out scents to go with certain potent potables. Feast your senses on coconut in the rum racks, French bread in the wine stacks, and cedar in the whiskey section. No word on whether these new aromas are bringing the smell of success to the cash register. But the Can West News Service says the liquor seller is hoping to expand the aromatherapy to 15 more stores. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 56 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq lost 15 points, 0.6%. And the S&P 500 shook off 12 points, 0.8%. Our producers include Megan Larson, Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, Fed dollars flowed south after Katrina, but was it enough?
From New Orleans perspective, I'm not sure we've got as much as we would like and need.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.